KPCW News Time now, 8:06. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. We've got 38 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City, 38 degrees in the Heber Valley, and no phone call from Cedric at the ABC Forecast Center, but I do have Paige on from the Utah Avalanche Center. Maybe you can give us a weather update, Paige. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Doing great, thanks.
All right. Yeah, the temperatures and spring sunshine are our biggest issues. I can certainly try my best with the weather and add that to my forecast update. This morning, the snowpack is generally stable and the avalanche danger is low. With strong sunshine and daytime warming, though, the danger could rise to moderate as the snow dampens on steep, sunny slopes and maybe even in some low to mid-elevation polar terrain. We're seeing overhanging cornices start to calve off in this warm weather, so stay back from them as they may break back much further than expected. This morning, skies are partly cloudy and mountain temperatures are hovering right around or just above freezing. Light winds at 9,000 feet are blowing from the northwest, while 11,000 foot winds are blowing from the west-northwest in the 20s and gusting into the 30s. Today, expect mostly to partly sunny skies with a 10,000 foot high around 41 degrees. And a west-northwesterly flow aloft will be in place today, so we'll have some occasional high clouds and light to moderate winds. High pressure builds into the area, or builds into the state tonight, and that'll remain in place through the rest of the work week. We'll see some really, really warm temperatures tomorrow and Friday. We haven't gotten any reports of recent avalanches, but we have seen some wet activity out there, mostly around rock bands. Biggest concern is, again, wet snow with these warm temperatures and strong sunshine. So if you start sinking into saturated snow sort of above your ankles, it's time to move to a cooler aspect elevation or lower angle terrain. If you see rollerballs or pinwheels, that's a sure sign that the snow is losing stability. Last thing I have is our regular daily avalanche forecast will end this Sunday, April 13th, and after that we'll issue updates when necessary, and we'll continue to publish public observations until May 1st.
Okay, always appreciate your team's efforts. Thanks, Paige.
Thanks, Leslie. Have a great day.
Stay tuned. In just a minute, we'll be checking in with President of Snow Sports Industry America, Nick Sargent, taking a look at some of the topics discussed during their recent conference here in Utah. Park City Manager Matt Dias previewing this week's City Council meeting. Council will be taking another look at the pedestrian crossing there at Kearns and as well as the outlying park and ride lots. And finally, from the U.S. Ski and Snowboard, CEO Sophie Goldschmidt with a look back at this historic season. Then stay tuned for the Mountain Live. Today's guests include Andrea Juskaitis of Sky Blue Coaching, talking about how families can support their college applicant through thrilling or disappointing college admissions decisions. Then a conversation with Jess Kimura, one of the most influential snowboarders of the past decade, who founded an event series for snowboarders. It's taking place at Woodbert Park City for 4 days starting tomorrow. All of that coming up on The Mountain Life, of course, heard every Wednesday from 9 to 10. Taking a look at some local news. An explosion at the new pump house in Oakley injured a worker on Monday. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports the blast is not, however, affecting the town's water supply.
The city of Oakley says the building exploded around 9 a.m. Monday, and it burned a subcontracted employee who was working on it. The man was flown to the University of Utah Medical Center. His condition was not immediately known. Summit County Fire Marshal Jackson Coleman says the new pump house may be a total loss. The cause is under investigation. Oakley officials say the city's immediate water operations were not affected because the well is not connected to the water system yet. The structure, which brings water up from the city's new well, was burning when the South Summit Fire Protection District crews arrived. The city says Planning Commissioner Jan Manning called 911. She lives about 150 yards from the fire, heard the explosion, and found the injured worker. She says she found a gentleman very stunned and very badly burned on his head and his hands, and she remained with him until firefighters and EMS arrived a few minutes later. Mayor Zane Wolstenholme said in a statement, "We are all taken aback by the unfortunate event that took place this morning, and our deepest condolences and best wishes go out to the construction worker, his family, and co-workers." City officials say the well would have been completed in the next 2 months if not for the explosion. The 2,000-foot-deep well exceeded expectations in early testing in late 2023. The overall project is about $5 million, and Councilmember Tom Smart says it is insured. He added the shaft of the well itself appears undamaged. Officials had hoped the well would more than double Oakley's water supply. The city paused all development 3 years ago for lack of water, but recently began approving new water system connections. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, SIA, or Snow Sports Industries America, recently held their global summit late last month. Some of the topics discussed were tariffs, forever chemicals, and European Union regulations. In the studio to tell us more, I have the president of SIA and Park City resident, Nick Sargent. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so start by telling us, Nick, what SIA is and why is it based here in Park City?
Snow Sports Industry America is the trade association that represents the winter sport business for North America. We're in Park City basically because this is the center of the winter sport business. It used to be in Washington, D.C., close to lobbying efforts, but more recently we've been here for 10 years and we're focused on the business that's happening not only here in Utah and in the West, but it's an easy access through the airport. And, you know, I say all roads pass through Park City at one point during the year for the winter sport industry.
Sure. And so, I mean, as a trade industry, I mean, are you doing a lot of lobbying with what, state and national?
Well, we've been pretty busy the last few weeks, specifically the last week. But beyond that, we're also very busy with the new regulations and compliance efforts that are happening not only in Europe, but also here in the U.S.
Okay, we'll talk a little bit about more about that. So you host this global summit then every year, or?
This is the second annual event, and the idea is that we'll continue to host this event for the coming years. Those that know SIA might remember the trade show that was in Las Vegas and then moved to Denver. You might remember the OR show. We sold our trade show to Outdoor Retailer years ago. And when we sold the trade show, we shifted our focus more towards trade show resilience, but also efforts to help our industry adjust to the ever-changing business of winter. So advocacy, data, a voice around tariffs, which we started with two administrations ago, and now we've picked up that work with a stronger intent. So we've really traded the trade show for a pure trade association, focusing on the issues that are affecting our business today.
All right, and the conference was held at the Sundance Resort, and you were saying a lot of people hadn't even never been there.
Sundance is a great host. We love Sundance. I love Sundance. It's such a wonderful resort, and it's so close to Park City. But ironically, when we hosted the event last year as a pilot event, majority of the people had never been to Sundance. They still thought Sundance was a movie event. They didn't realize it was an actual ski resort. So when we hosted the second annual event, we had over 150 people attend, C-suite leaders within the winter sport business. So it was a great introduction to Sundance, not only the skiing, the resort, early ups, but the facilities and certainly the views are amazing.
Wow. You opened the conference moderating a conversation about the future of winter business. So given our changing climate, how optimistic are you for snow sports in the future?
Oh, I'm very optimistic. That's my role in this world, but certainly we have some headwinds in front of us. We are facing new issues around forever chemicals. You touched on that just a second ago with PFAS. This industry, amongst a litany of other industries, that have PFAS chemicals on home products, that wasn't immune to just those products. It seeped its way into outdoor products. And we have certainly textiles that have made a career in chemicals. And now we are moving away from that. And that's really hard when you have a proven product, consumer buy-in, and now you have to change your textile makeup. That's happening not just here in the U.S., but it's also happening in Europe. And so we have a global phenomenon that we have to solve. Making products that are sustainable, have a long user life, and aren't recycled too soon, but are reused, used until the end of their life cycle. We're also facing issues around shipping materials, boxes, peanuts, bubble wrap, poly wrap, plastic, and that, you know, is a huge issue for all industries, but our little winter sport industry is affected as well. So we're making adjustments to how that product is packaged and doing our part to be sustainable in that space.
Yeah, so these PFAS, I mean, it's not just the high fluorocarbon ski waxes anymore. It's the, well, it's the waterproof materials that we want to be outside with.
That's right, and it's also the sourcing materials. So if you think about a jacket and you break that jacket down into the 35 or 37 pieces that, you know, pre-sewn, where does that material come from? A zipper, a liner, insulation, outer textile. So, you know, what materials are you using and what is the sustainable approach that you're having towards that product? If you take that one step further and you look at a ski or a snowboard, what's the wood inside that core? Where is that coming from? And that sourcing agent, what are they doing to replant the trees, replenish the forest from that wood that's taken, as well as the foam, the base material, the aluminum edges, the poly wrap, the titanol, the fiberglass. So all of that is now coming under scrutiny. In the EU, majority of the larger winter sport hard good brands are in the EU. I belong to a group of CEOs that are focused on this. So if you can imagine the CEO of Rossignol, Atomic Solomon. So we're all trying to solve this before it becomes law in 2028.
Well, that's interesting, though, because what we see traditionally under the Republican administration is a lifting of regulations. So it's the ski industry, actually, it's like, well, we need to do this just because we want to be considered sustainable.
Well, it's not just that we want to do it. The states are dictating the product. So California, New York, Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, Minnesota. Coming on next year will be Utah, Colorado. So everyone's going to have their own regulations that are in alignment, but have varying differentiations between how they're reporting this material. So in Europe, it's a little easier because you have the European Union, which represents the 13 nations. Here in the U.S., we've got each state that are adopting these regulations but having nuances that are specific to their state. So we're reporting all of that information on snowsports.org. You can go there and you can look at the product, you can look at the state, and you can see the affected compliances that you're going to have to adjust to.
Hmm. All right. Well, let's move on to tariffs because, I mean, even, you know, the headlines popping up right now, you know, is that after President Trump imposed a 104% tariff on Chinese good, Beijing announcing a levy of U.S. goods of 84%. I mean, back and forth, back and forth. I know that you spent some time talking about tariffs at the summit. So what's going on?
I mean, this is a moving target. It's the top of news. I'm looking at the screen behind you here, and I'm reading the headlines as we're speaking. And it's fluid. So these tariffs are obviously top of news, but they're also changing or adjusting depending on the mood in Washington, or the conversations that each of these countries are having in Washington. Certainly, a lot of material, winter sport product, is made in China. So you can imagine if you're a small brand and you are making and manufacturing your product in China at 104%, that tariff might be worth more than the product itself. So the issue there is that we're focused on this smaller company that might not be able to afford that tariff of that magnitude. If they haven't already looked at moving to a more manufacturing friendly nation, this certainly is going to be eyes open and, you know, what do you do next conversation within that small company. That being said, it's not just China. You've seen the list. We've seen the list. We focused on it. Some of the smaller countries like Vietnam, for example, that's known for building PEGs, PACs, you know, they're affected as well. So a lot of the winter sport brands are building contingency plans, building that into their manufacturing, and they don't know if that's an A, B, C, D, E, or F plan. They're going that deep in their planning to really understand what is going to be the effect on the manufacturing, on the sell into the retailer, which just happened. So the prices were negotiated in November, December. The orders were put in February, March, and now the tariffs have risen to an extreme.
Right. So what is the impact, though? I mean, do we just start to see goods that just nobody can afford?
Well, that's really where our focus is today, because that's the unknown. We don't know what that is. We know what the percentages are. We know that's 20% coming out of Europe. We know Canada has gone back and forth. We also have seen China. We've also seen Vietnam. We've also seen some of the other Asian companies where there's manufacturing as well. So you can look at those tariffs and you can adjust that percentage into your manufacturing. But what we don't know and what has yet to be decided is, the manufacturer going to push that through to the retailer, to the consumer? Is the manufacturer going to subsidize that tariff in effort to save the lower pricing? There's also talk that maybe Washington might change their tone by the time the product is delivered in August, and there might be some savings there or some form of a payback, but we don't know what that is. We're also focusing on other elements of exemptions, and you know, so we're tracking HTS codes, which they are the government identifier of every piece of product. So if it's a glove, a scarf, a knit, a hat, a jacket, a backpack, which is boiled down to a school pack, a technical backpack or a true alpine pack. So we go down to the granular to really understand what products are affected, what those tariffs are, and how we can not only educate the supplier manufacturer, but also the retailer.
Yeah. So are we headed for any supply chain issues like we saw back in the day of the pandemic?
Well, I mean, as we've all been reading and getting this information together, you know, the oil that's used to and the gasoline that's used to fuel the ships, the trains, the FedEx, the UPS trucks, that is all being tariffed as well. So there are new costs that are coming forward to the manufacturer for shipping that material to whether it's the U.S. in this case or it's other parts of the world, specifically the U.S. But so they have to build in those increased shipping costs. And we don't know if the ports are going to get backed up. We don't know if labor unions are going to strike. So there's a lot of unknowns there as well. So we're tracking that and making sure that our constituents understand the cause and the effect.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, some of that shipping material, that's kind of interesting. I mean, are there new ways to do that? Because nobody wants damaged goods, right?
Nobody wants damaged goods. I mean, we all get a couple boxes a week at our doorstep. But if you think about the packaging, and you know, the example is, I'm not going to name names, but you know, your favorite blue delivery truck, and you know, we've all received a cell phone cover that comes in a box that's 8 times the size and is full of packaging. If you compound that across our country, and we're not even talking winter sport product, we're just talking shipping products in general, that's overflowing our trash companies and our landfills, and we can't remove that material quick enough. So it's increasing costs on your trash, it's increasing costs on your landfills. Take that, you know, infinite steps further, talking about skis and snowboards, and of course we don't want that material damaged. So the manufacturer is having to come up with new solutions. There are new solutions for cardboard. There are new solutions for plastics and bubble wraps and peanuts and things of that nature. But that comes at an expense as well.
Another panel discussion that caught my eye looking at the schedule was the new role of rental. So how is that changing? I mean, is it moving toward what we're starting to see, kind of like the ski butler, where things are brought to you as opposed to kind of, you know, getting through the rental lines?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and you see it here in Park City, you know, Ski Butler and Black Tie, and there's a number of others that are out here delivering product. You know, the reality is that it's cumbersome to travel with your skis, your boots, your poles, your bags, a couple kids, you know, and it's expensive. The airlines aren't making it easy on you, although there are some shipping alternatives through FedEx and UPS, but the reality is that it's much easier just to roll into a resort with your ski boots or even not and have a black tie or someone bring that product to you if it snows like it does here, they can change that product from a narrow waist to a fat waist, and you can really enjoy your experience, you know, here in Park City, but that's happening all over the world. So rentals huge, and it's not just those second-tier rental groups. This is happening at resort as well, and the resorts are seeing more opportunity to cater to their customer with higher quality rentals, and that goes not just for skis, boots, bindings, or snowboards, boots, bindings, but that goes to apparel and helmets and goggles and gloves, and making that experience really nice and pleasurable for those.
Hmm. All right. Something we have heard a few times this winter are chairlift problems. Many resorts, I'm thinking, have aging lift infrastructure that's very expensive to replace or mm-hmm. to upgrade. So is that part of the reason we're seeing such a consolidation of ski resorts?
Not necessarily. I mean, you know, you have 400 and I can't remember the exact number, 435 resorts here in just the U.S., you know, and each resort has capital improvements and infrastructure updates. Certainly chairlifts, you know, are meant to last a while. And I can say in speaking to some of my friends in the resort community that they're looking, you know, at capital improvements, when, where, how, and certainly the expense. That's a little more challenged in today's conversation with these tariffs, especially with steel and aluminum. Majority of the chairlifts come out of Austria, so there's going to be 25% tariff, not only on chairlifts, but also snowcasts, et cetera. So if you're a resort operator, you're looking at what are your capital improvements, what are those increased costs, and how are we going to manage this over the summer?
Huh. All right, even more expensive. I mean, and we know skiing is an expensive sport to begin with.
It is. I mean, certainly there are ways around that expensive sport. I always say you don't go to Pebble Beach for your first round of golf. You go to your local, nine-holer. The same goes for winter sports. You know, there are plenty of alternatives to going to a much larger resort as your first time, but with discounted opportunities, if you are following all of the emails from Vail or Alterra or the Multi Mountain Pass, if you buy your pass early, it's, you know, takes a little bit of the bite off. But if you're caught at the window, you're going to pay a little bit more. So plan ahead.
Yeah. Finally, wanted to ask you just about, as the kind of skier demographic ages, how is the industry attracting younger skiers?
Yeah, right. So that's a big issue as well. Baby boomers are leaving the sport at record numbers and moving to warmer weather climates and participating in different sports that are less intrusive to their bodies. Mm-hmm. But you know, we have a real opportunity to get people of color on slope, and you know, that's a shift that's happening. Whether you know it's skiing, it's golf, it's tennis. You know, we have a huge population, and there's a large diversity that we can call on and make them welcome into our community and give them the opportunities that we've had, and the opportunities that really are right in front of them. So we have to be more accessible to bringing more people on slope and being welcoming of that.
Okay. Hey, anything else you wanted to? Parting words, thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, as I said early on at the start here, we have some headwinds, but there's just as much opportunity as there are headwinds. And so the more diligent we can be and the more opportunistic we can be, you know, we'll continue to thrive. And we have a beautiful environment here in Park City. As I look at your studio, the snow's still white, and there's plenty of opportunity to continue to ski and finish off the season strong. So take advantage of it.
Okay, Nick, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Nick Sargent is the president of SIA, that's Snow Sport Industries America. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. The Park City Council meets tomorrow, starting a work session at 3:45 to discuss the long-term park and ride strategy. In the studio with a meeting preview, I have City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having me today.
Yeah, so let's talk park and ride. Three locations have been identified, all at the Quinns Junction area there near US 40 and 248. You know, just thinking about how we now need to build more park and ride, did we miss the opportunity by not widening SR 248 when we had a chance to from UDOT?
Well, I don't know. I guess it depends on who you ask that question, obviously. I think that's a complicated question, and At the time, working with UDOT, there, I believe there was a, my recollection 10 years ago or 8 years ago, is there was a pretty big public hearing held in the Eccles Center, where I want to recall we had several hundred residents, locals, residents, employees, or otherwise that were there, and there was a lot of concern about a widening project on one of our two major arterials here in town. And I think at that time, at a policy level, the mayor and council decided that the widening was inconsistent with our community values and inconsistent with the feedback they had heard. And in lieu of a widening project, they sought to increase capacity on the corridor using other means and methods, improving the rail trail, improving the trusses, providing express bus lanes, ramping up the park and ride at Richardson Flat. And I think every time we have kind of a new collection of mayor and council, they get to deliberate over this issue. And to be fair, this issue is taking place across the country. Do you widen the roads or do you try to come up with additional means and methods to increase capacity? You know, that being said, we understand that that's the most congested arterial in our community. It's where the bulk of our visitors and our workforce are coming from. And that's the reason we feel that there's another opportunity to take a contemplative step back and determine if we want to enhance the services at the existing Richardson Flat location, or if we want to pursue a different location altogether. And I wish I had the master key on this. I wish I could just turn the key and come up with the ultimate solution. But this group will have the opportunity to deliberate over that. And we feel that there's sort of things that are converging with the money that we obtained with Deer Valley, the $15 million. We have a great partnership with UDOT, working with them, and High Valley Transit and Summit County. We just conducted a regional park and ride study. And the study recommended that the county focus on what's conventionally known as the front door on the 224 corridor, and that the municipality really spend its time and its attention on the back door. And so that's what we're doing.
So, I mean, the thinking was that Richardson Flat as the park and ride wasn't going to work, but we found out that it actually is quite successful.
To be fair, it's exceeded our expectations. I think I'm going off recollection here, but almost 15 to 20,000 different riders, either going to Park City Mountain Resort, Deer Valley Resort, or Old Town. And, we had days that were near 500 in totality parking in that. But we do know it's an inferior location, and it doesn't really reflect the enhanced level of service that drives transit ridership. So if we are interested in pursuing that location as our long-term solution, the administrative team wants to come up with a slew of initiatives to enhance the services out there, restrooms, lighting, Wi-Fi, all the things that make it comfortable for a rider and might get someone out of their vehicle or meet someone there to carpool into town. That being said, property ownership is an issue. There's a bunch of environmental concerns. So like anything, I wish I had the master key to sort of just turn this on, but it's going to take some time and deliberation.
All right. So right now, you're able to use 650 parking spots. There's 750, but 100 of those, as I recall, are reserved. So is there some thinking that we expand that?
Very potentially. There is... the lease area altogether is far larger than just the asphalt that you see out there today. But again, we don't own the property. It's on an environmental site. There's a long way to go. However, again, it's exceeded our expectations, and we're checking in with this group. Do they want to select this location to enhance? Do they want to select another location? Or even potentially in the report, our strategy contemplates there could be a nuanced approach here. We have a short, medium, and sort of a long-term goal where we're using multiple park and rides. One could be overflow, special events, and have lower level of service. Another one could be express, everyday level of service that an employee could rely upon to get them to their locations. There's a bunch of nuances in here we're going to work through.
Okay, the Gordo lot, as it's known, is city property, and that could come online soon. It had been contemplated for a park and ride, and I think that's where you were thinking the $15 million from Deer Valley would be spent?
Well, yeah, I think to be fair, 2 years ago, or almost a year ago, we were really focused on the Gordo Park and Ride site, and we have gone through an extensive environmental cleanup, and I believe we're just weeks away from getting a completion letter. So going as far back to early mid-2000s, the city had received a comfort letter to store some temporary soils and materials there. Construction projects like the tunnel that goes under Bonanza Drive, a bunch of other construction projects in our community were storing soils there. We've now remediated those. And so that site now is primed for the next best community use. That could be recreation and open space. It could be residential, affordable housing. It could be commercial. It could be a park and ride. It could be a lot of different things.
Okay. And then we've kind of done away with the plans for the park and ride property that was on UDOT property between US 40 and old US 40?
I think, unfortunately, it seems like that sort of alternative may have passed, or that option may have passed. And I mean, unfortunately, because it's always nice to have additional options on the table. But that parcel is now in deep talks and negotiations between the Department of Alcoholic Beverage Services, DABS, I think I got that acronym correct, and UDOT to put in a regional liquor store.
Hmm. Okay, so what happens next here? This discussion and then plans for...
We hope we get a bunch of questions from council about either enhancing the level of service at the existing park and ride, or coming up with a nuanced strategy to maybe have two park and rides, depending on the project location and the types of services that they want. But my guess is we get a bunch of questions and some work to do. Our team is asking, though, sometime this summer, if we could potentially have a project location to really start working towards.
Okay. We're reporting that High Valley Transit moving full steam ahead on plans for the 224 BRT bus rapid transit lanes. A couple of Park City Council members were concerned about widening 224 within city limits. So, I mean, where are we at with this? I mean, is it too bad you guys got to the party too late here to change plans? Or are you meeting with UDOT privately to see what you can do? Or what's going on here?
I think all of the above. I you know, obviously that's a very sensitive stretch in our community. We call it from the Catholic Church sort of to the White Barn. And it's a relatively short truncation overall for the project. And so there's a healthy and rigorous debate between Summit County, High Valley, Park City Municipal, and UDOT about the effectiveness and the efficiencies that are obtained by having a standalone lane and the widening that would occur vis-a-vis having that project amended or adapted a little to have it ride within the existing right-of-way. And so that's currently under debate between the partners. And I understand High Valley's Transit's position. They're a mission-driven organization. Their mission is drive more people into transit and make transit-first projects. I don't want to say come hell or high water, but they're mission-driven, and I understand that. However, if you think about the municipality's mission, we have numerous additional stakeholders than a transit agency. And so, you know, we're this comprehensive city of young people and old people and employees and residents. And so I think our mayor and council are listening to some of the community feedback that they've heard. There's obviously a historic kind of iconic structure there, and we're trying to be sensitive to that corridor.
Yeah. You want people to ride the bus, though. And making it longer to get from point A to point B is not going to get people on the bus.
You know, I think in simplistic terms, we agree. But I think if you took a step back and looked at the analysis, the near-term efficacy of that widening is marginal. It's on the margins, to be fair. There's not if you and I, you know, drove in and out of here every day, that's not a part of the roadway that's typically congested. I think anyone could just see that by driving in and out every day. That's also demonstrated in the data and analysis. However, sometimes these projects are looking 10, 20, 40 years ahead, and they're looking at peak periods and special events. And to your point, anything you can do to enhance the buses and the transit system will bring more people into ridership. This is the balancing act. I'll say it again. I wish I had a master key to just say, here's the right decision and everyone's going to agree. It's very difficult to obtain consensus when you're making public decisions with this much money, this much scope, and this much complexity.
Yeah, but the city's not going to throw a wrench in these plans, is it?
I don't know. I mean, that's obviously going to have to be a decision between our legislative body, our mayor and council, High Valley Transit, UDOT, and Summit County. I'd like to say there's still a great deal of discussion to be had. We're working with our partners. And dare I say, this is part of the process. I've been part of a few of these in the past, transit-oriented development, big light rail projects back east. And these projects take years, if not decades, and they're always hard at the end.
Okay. Budget discussion started earlier this year. Department heads went through what was called a more rigorous review process. I guess basically what, to find money, to do things with less money, and to look at how to save on staffing. So what did the city's DOGE experts find here?
I don't think I used the word DOGE, so Just to begin, we're an efficient organization. Our assets and our facilities are in incredible condition. We run a pretty lean and mean operations and staffing enterprise as it is. However, revenue outlook for next year is flat. It's relatively flat. And so we've asked our divisions and our departments to find some efficiencies to cover their inflationary increases. If you and I were to order pens today or printer or paper or software and technology, things are just a little bit more expensive last year. So we've asked our divisions to come up with any cost-saving measures that they have. We are strengthening our performance protocols with position management. And in addition, we've had some big cost busters. Our health insurance at one point was up almost 30% through a competitive RFP process. We've knocked that down to roughly 13 or 15%. Dare I say, we're still pretty early in the process. We begin internally in January, and as every winter month comes through, which are our strongest 3 months, we will revise our projections. So there's an opportunity here that we could revise our revenue projections and maybe do a little bit more. But the nuts and bolts of this budget is making investments in public safety, public works, recreation, and transportation. That's the only place that you'll really see net new increases in terms of any personnel or staffing or otherwise. So excited about it, but we're still early in the process.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the police department getting the biggest increase, over about $800,000 if the request goes through for a new...
There's a lot of things going on in there. There's a senior detective that we've been looking at for a number of years, just given the volume and increase in cases that are occurring in our police department. And then there's some new state legislation that was basically, for lack of a better term, an unfunded mandate for additional school resource officers. We'll be working with Summit County and the Summit County Sheriff and the school district on how to fund those. There's a few different things happening in the law enforcement world.
Yeah, and also the Sundance numbers were thrown in there. So is the city going to save money after not hosting Sundance?
Long term. Yeah, I think long term, but that's a double-edged question. I think Sundance, just in terms of an economic impact, has a tremendous economic impact here locally, from big businesses to small, and there are some acute sectors of our economy that will be overnight, you know, drastically impacted. If you're in the lodging industry or restaurant industry and you have a tradition of selling out or special lodging rates, there's going to be a direct impact. I think at a macro level, we believe we can fill that in with skiers economically, but there's still sort of the cultural wound and there's the kind of the legacy wound. And so we're balancing those. Long term, though, as you know, we provide a lot of services in terms of closing Main Street, traffic, pedestrian, law enforcement, business licensing that we will not incur moving forward.
Okay, the pedestrian crossing alternatives on Kearns Boulevard. I think the council's reiterated they prefer, their preferred option is a tunnel under Kearns, but it sounds like you're just going to take some short-term steps here and put in one of those hawk beacon signals like we see in front of Fresh Market?
Potentially. We agree. I think council understands the safest solution and most elegant solution is a tunnel. It's also the most disruptive and expensive, and when you do something like that, the preference is to have partnership on both sides of the roads with the property owners. There was a development application that had potentially a great deal of partnership in it, and recently that didn't make it through the Planning Commission. And so in the near term, we'll likely be pursuing some temporary solution unless council wants us to move forward with the full tunnel. So we'll be back with that probably in a couple weeks.
Okay, and the city sounds like it is moving forward with ranked choice voting. So what needs to happen before this year's municipal election?
Well, you know, not too much, to be honest. We're doing a little bit of work with the Summit County Clerk's Office. You know, ranked choice voting is conducted throughout the state and has been for the better part, I think, almost 6 or 8 years now. And so what the thrust of it is, it really eliminates the primary. And so people need to declare for office kind of much later than they ever would before. So it happens much later, I think, in the middle of the summer. And the municipality does probably more than any other city in town I'm aware of in terms of how to run for office, trainings, pamphlets, information on our website. And so we'll be making sure that we educate the public about the change, what's changed, when the changes occur. We'll have a, you know, how to run for office session. So more to come probably later this spring, early summer.
All right. And finally, the council decided it wanted to redo the Bonanza 5-acre request for proposals. When do the new ones get opened?
Well, they're opened and they're currently under review by the same scoring committee that scored the first round. And so my hope is we're back here in the next you know, dare I say 45 days with sort of two finalists or a couple finalists for the mayor and council to review and vet and interview. I think we're at an exciting moment, and I'm really fingers and toes crossed that we'll have a quality developer to move forward with once and for all.
Okay. Anything else, Matt, you want to mention?
No, that's it. Thanks so much for having me, and I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. That's Matt Dias, Park City City Manager. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. In the studio now with the season recap from US Ski and Snowboard, I have CEO Sophie Goldschmidt. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Yeah, so let's start with some of the athletic successes this year. I mean, a historic year between Michaela Schifrin and Lindsey Vonn, yeah?
Yeah, it was a very exciting season, particularly towards the end, as you know, we had the Stiefel's Sun Valley World Cup finals, and Lindsey had an incredible performance, podiuming for the first time since she has embarked on her amazing comeback, and Michaela ended the season very strongly, finishing as the winner of the slalom at World Cup finals. So yeah, a great way to finish.
Yeah, it's great to have rock stars like that out there, huh? I mean, it just creates a lot of buzz for U.S. Ski and Snowboard.
It does, a lot of buzz, and just helps to grow the profile of our sports and athletes. And we're fortunate to have so many world-class athletes in other sports as well. We had some record seasons. Chloe Kim, first female athlete ever to win three world championship gold medals, coming back really strongly. Maddie Mastro actually won the globe in the women's snowboard half pipe. Alex Hall, a local, also won a globe. Jessie Diggins, incredibly, won her third overall cross-country globe, the only non-Scandinavian to ever dominate like she has in cross-country, and she also won the distance globe. So yeah, we had a lot of results that we're very proud of across the season, and momentum's building nicely, and it's great to also see the camaraderie and support across our teams. You see them supporting each other, going to each other's events, and you can really see that sort of spark of inspiration. When one team starts doing well, maybe another team that's been struggling a bit suddenly gets that confidence boost, and yeah, I've been really pleased just to see that sort of camaraderie and support more broadly between our sports.
Yeah, and I don't think that this has happened either, is to have three sisters. I mean, I'm thinking of Masugas, you know, as part of U.S. Ski and Snowboard with three different disciplines.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, and I don't know what's in their water, but I mean, Lauren in particular had just a breakout season. She finished very strong last season. She won her first World Cup. She podiumed. She has just, yeah, had a fantastic year, and Ali and Sam are also doing well. Ali coming back from a little bit of injury this year, but actually winning a NORAM title and in great shape heading into next season. And then Sam on the jumping side. And they've got a younger brother too, who's a pretty good alpine ski racer. So who knows, there could be a fourth Masuga joining our teams in the future.
All right. So this is kind of the year before the Olympics, right? So tell us what kind of that lead-in is for U.S. Ski and Snowboard.
Yeah, look, things definitely have already ramped up. I mean, to be honest, our planning started about a month after Beijing finished. A huge amount of logistical preparation goes into an Olympics, especially, funny enough, in Milan Cortina, which is going to be amazing. But actually, there are some challenges as well. It's a very spread-out Olympics, so we'll be competing at four different venues. To give you an example, the women alpine events will take place in Cortina, which is 6 hours from when the men will compete, on the same day in Bormio. Livigno is another 3.5 hours away, and then cross country's another 3 hours from that. So logistically, we've literally got to have four different base camps, which isn't normally what it would be like for us during Olympics. Maybe you'd have two. And then just making sure that we have all the right planning, the accommodation, the food, all the sort of other support needs that our athletes require in order to compete at their best. So yeah, a lot of planning is underway, and then just day in, day out, making sure that the athletes are developing in the best way possible to peak at those moments. Rightly so, everyone around the world is particularly obsessed and engaged around the Olympics. To be honest, week in, week out. I mean, the World Cup that take place every weekend mean a lot. We feel if you're doing well week in, week out, then the Olympics will take care of themselves as well. You know, who finishes the season as the number one athlete, which is winning a globe in our sports, also I think just shows that you've got the consistency to then do it on a big stage. So yeah, but look, momentum, pressure, excitement is building, I think, in a really positive way. And there'll be twists and turns. There'll be athletes that'll break through over the next 9 months that we haven't expected. affected. And, you know, unfortunately with our sports, you also get some horrific injuries as well. So really just trying to look at it holistically, support as many athletes as we can, so that the best ones have the chance to optimize their potential on the big day.
Yeah, now have the athletes been able to ski or ride on those Olympic venues this season?
Yes, they have, to varying degrees. So, for example, in Alpine, the women have a World Cup race in Cortina. They have for the last few years, so they're quite familiar with it. The men aren't there as consistently, but they've done some training there. Our freestyle team had a test event in Livigno where they'll compete about a month ago. Val di Fiemme, which is where the cross country will take place, there was a World Cup this year. Snowboard, free ski, not so much. They actually haven't finished building those venues yet, so there is nowhere to really test. I think that's one concern we've got, is that some of the venues are going to be finished very late. Some have been in place for years, but look, some of that is always part of sort of an Olympic cycle. But with some of those where, you know, snow conditions are pretty key, ideally you would have time to practice before. I don't think that's going to be possible with a couple of the disciplines. But yeah, look, the preparation and getting as much time on the features and the tracks that we're going to be racing on is obviously absolutely key. So we're using our relationships in Italy and with other groups to make sure that we get the best training and prep that we possibly can. But you've got to adapt. You've got to be flexible too. I mean, especially with the weather and climate change at the moment, things can change, you know, incredibly quickly. So it's also sort of the mentality and just, you know, making sure that we're continuing to help our athletes develop on that front to, really be ready to deal with any situation in any circumstance. I mean, I remember Beijing last time around. That was sort of my second month on the job, and you couldn't make it up. I mean, how do you prepare for that? But, you know, they showed resiliency, and teamwork kind of got us through that.
Yeah. And fundraising just a year out from the Olympics, how's that going for
us? Yeah, it's we've had a really good year. This year we'll have another record revenue year. Thank goodness, because the cost of these sports and to be competitive certainly isn't becoming any easier. And there's so many programs that we still want to add for our athletes. We want to support more athletes as well, so we can start, you know, developing talent even earlier in the pipeline. So while we're in a good place, we're always hungry and working really hard to get more. And look, as you've rightly pointed out, leading into an Olympics, our profile and the interest in our sports will grow. And that's a great opportunity for us to tap into new donors and new groups that may be interested in supporting us in different ways. So it's going to be a busy summer. We've definitely got, you know, quite a big to-go number to fully fund everything we want to next year. But hopefully, if the market doesn't keep tanking, then we can do all right. But no, a big thank you to all those, especially locally. We have so many amazing supporters of our athletes, whether they're housing them, you know, helping them, you know, get further education, or just donating to our program so that we can fully fund their training and competitive schedules. We're really grateful for all the local support here. It's amazing.
Yeah, and kind of looking ahead here, though, I mean, we had Nick Sargent from SIA on earlier just talking about the expense now with the tariffs. Skiing is certainly going to be hit hard by that, skiing and riding, just not only with the uniforms but the equipment. So how do you possibly kind of plan for that? Because not only do they have uniforms for the season, you're going to buy them Olympic uniforms as well.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a challenge. Look, we're fortunate. We've got some amazing partners, quite long-term relationships. To be honest, they sort of bear the cost increases. We get what you call VIK, value in kind. So we get a lot of that gear and equipment for free, but it impacts them. So when those partnerships come up for renewal, they're obviously going to be stretched, and, you know, their cost base is changing significantly. I mean, look, let's see what it's like in another couple of months, but I think very disruptive for the industry and for many sectors.
Yeah. And we should note another successful Intermountain Health Freestyle International event at Deer Valley. Looking ahead to next season, do we have more of those local events coming back?
We do. So the Intermountain Health Freestyle World Cup is a highlight on the calendar. Deer Valley do an amazing job. It is the best World Cup on the freestyle World Cup schedule. So we love coming back here, and that's for both moguls and aerials. We are having some discussions with others about potentially adding other events, especially as we look ahead to 34. They will need to do various test events, and I think there'll just be more interest and support in bringing other events here, especially, unfortunately, with Sundance leaving. There is potentially now more room for other events to come to this area. We had a record year. We've never had more World Cups than we had this season across all of our sports. We had 12 different events, which is huge for us. I mean, that home field advantage is real. Initially, it's quite a lot of pressure for the athletes, but after a couple of years, they get used to it and they just soak up the atmosphere, and it really inspires them to achieve amazing things. But it really helps the next generation. I mean, the number of our elite stars who have said to me, I got into wanting to be a pro athlete because I saw my hero competing here. So for me, it's really important for the future and the next generation of talent, and also for our partners and sponsors to be able to activate in the US and not have to just do it through broadcasts and following us in the middle of the night in Europe. So overall, it's worked really well. We just came off, as I mentioned, the Stiefel Sun Valley World Cup Finals, which was a huge success. I mean, a big shout out to Sun Valley. I mean, the local support we got there for a year, one event, was quite incredible. And it's kind of what we see here at Deer Valley. You know, when you're in these communities that don't have that many other big events, they get so excited and are so proud to show off their town. So yeah, hopefully we can bring more to this area.
Okay, I'm about out of time. Anything else you wanted to add real quick?
No, I mean, just look out. We've got lots of athletes here all summer training at the USANA Center of Excellence. We have now 240 athletes that we fully fund. They'll all be here for various weeks. So they're proud to call themselves locals fully or part-time. And just very grateful for the support. And start getting ready for next season. A big year, as you say, leading into the Milan Cortina Olympics, which starts the beginning of February 2026. So let's go.
Okay. Sophie, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Sophie Goldschmidt is the CEO of U.S. Ski and Snowboard. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.